So I'd like to speak for some time, maybe half an hour, maybe a bit more, and then there'll be some time to explore, respond, ask about either what I've been speaking about or anything else. We seem to be, as human beings, we seem to be most essentially organs of consciousness. So I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by that. First of all, we seem to be a few different ways of describing it. Life's way of knowing itself. We could describe ourselves, or we seem to be, if we look very closely at what it is, this kind of self-evident beingness, right? But we can't remember a beginning to it, although we've got a story about how it began, right? It began with our birth, etc., etc. We can't remember. It's beginningless. Right? Being conscious is beginningless. We can't remember. We can't find a start point. And endless, in terms of we can't anticipate or we can't really understand anything to do with after an end of consciousness. Again, we might have stories about that. Those stories might involve the end of consciousness at death, or they might involve some variation, either a kind of heaven and hell variation or a multiple life kind of variation, on what might happen to consciousness after death. But we certainly can't even begin to conceive of anything, of any experience after consciousness. Well, no consciousness, there's nothing there to have any experience. So wherever we posit the beginning or the ending of this very fact of being aware, being conscious, being alive, the fact is, the self-evident fact, it's so self-evident, it's so primary, it's so core to every aspect of all our experience all the time, that we tend to overlook it, because it's so self-evident. But if we actually contemplate it, look, here we are now, self-evidently conscious. And that's quite profoundly mysterious. So mysterious that we often don't know what to do with it. So much so, we don't know what this is, what this means, that we tend to just kind of, we tend to ignore it and just get caught up in the various this's and that's that arise in consciousness, the stuff to do with my body and my mind and my relationships and my stories and my wants and my needs and my memories. Or, when we get into kind of religious territory, the tendency is, confronted by this extraordinary mystery of being conscious, to explain it away. And we might explain it away in one or other of the various kind of mythological or religious cosmologies about the beginning of the world and the end of the world and various kind of authorities that describe how life is that we might believe in or not believe in, agree with or disagree with, etc. But Dharma practice invites us to come back from the first way of just getting lost in all the different bits, and invites us not to land in the second way with any kind of convenient description of what it is to be human or what life is about. The Buddha rather extraordinarily refused to get into any kind of metaphysics, refused to come up with a cosmology, refused to discuss the beginning of the universe or the end of the universe. And instead, really, really encouraged us to redirect our attention back to this fundamental, essential, self-evident truth of being conscious, of being sensitive. We're sensitive to life. We have these organs of sensitivity. Right? Eyes, we're sensitive to what's seen. Ears, we're sensitive to what's heard. We're sensitive to the various ways of experiencing, smelling, tasting, touching, etc. Also sensitive to thought and memory. We're sensitive in an emotional sense, sensitive to feelings. And it seems, because this is both self-evident and profoundly mysterious, one of the kind of, or the central convenient organising principle that we come up with to make sense of this sensitivity to ourselves is that there's kind of some central controller of the sensitivity called me, right? And that makes sense to us. It does make sense on a conventional level. We can speak about how I came into being and how I developed and the problems I had along the way and what I'm hoping to do about it and etc. But the invitation, like I say, is to put aside our assumptions, to actually recognise the assumptions that we have already made, and to explore as directly as we can this field of sensitivity that we are, that moves in these different directions, as I say, the field of sensitivity through our organs as well as through heart and mind, etc. And maybe others, let's see as we go on. The Buddha's description of what it is to be a human being, he spoke about in terms of these different sensitivities, the skandhas, for those of you who are familiar with Pali, the kind of classical Buddhist teachings. Skandhas means collections of sensitivities, which he spoke about as sensational sensitivity. All that comes to us physically, feelings, the way we kind of respond empathically, the liking and disliking, the kind of the feeling drawn towards or feeling repelled by modern feelings, perceptions, the sensitivity we have to life. And that kind of organising principle we have, so that we say, oh yes, you and you, and here and there, and this and that. Sensitivity of mental construction. States of mind, emotions. More kind of layering of our experience into more and more complexity. And the sensitivity, finally, of consciousness itself. So these five collections of sensitivities, which is a kind of a bit of a rough free translation for the word skanda that the Buddha used, is how he described what it means to be a human being. And somebody then once asked him, well, what's the difference between an everyday confused human being and a free, liberated human being? And he says, the only difference is clinging. Everyday confused human being is body, feelings, perceptions, mental constructions and consciousness affected by clinging. Clinging to these things as who I am. Clinging to these things as somehow solid. Clinging to these things in terms of the story that I carry around about what this means and who I am. And how I bring this kind of rigid structure that I've come to believe in to relate to others. And a liberated human being, he says, is body, feelings, perceptions, mental constructions, consciousness itself. All the same process is happening. And that's important. All the same process is happening, unaffected by clinging. So I'd just like to explore a little bit, and in light of the way we've been practicing today, in light of this emphasis on here, now, like this. In other words, all these natural processes of body, heart and mind going on, and the possibility to investigate them, investigate this kind of field of sensitivity that we are. to investigate it in such a way as to free it up, so that we don't make this unnecessary and painful, or so that we don't continue to make this unnecessarily painful assumption. So that we don't continue to cling on in the rigid, neurotic, fearful way that makes our life feel like a struggle, feel painful, feel fearful, rather than feeling like a free process of bodily life, sensational life, feeling life, mental life, conscious life. So Dharma practice, most fundamentally, I think, is firstly the honouring, and in fact the enhancing of this sensitivity we have. And then the training of how to respond to this sensitivity wisely, skillfully. The skill that's conventionally called in Buddhism wisdom and compassion. So firstly, the honouring and enhancing of this sensitivity. We were born sensitive and vulnerable. You look at a newborn child, incredibly sensitive to everything, to light, to touch, to any kind of stimulus. See how engaged a baby is. Vulnerable, right? Dependent on certain kinds of important care for its survival. And our sensitivity, you know, spreads out and continues in different ways. And along the way, inevitably, of course, growing up, our sensitivity kind of gets bruised in different ways. Some of the things that our sensitivity, this openness we have to physical experience, to emotional experience, this openness to the touch of life, which I'm calling basic sensitivity. You know, sometimes the way life impacts is difficult, is painful. And because of the nature of our sensitivity, physical sensitivity, emotional sensitivity, that gets bruised, and we kind of, there's a sort of cellular memory, it seems, of those things. We kind of store, usually unconsciously, the impacts. Physical impacts. If when we were very young we got very cold, or if we were dropped and something that would make a very big impact on us in a way we wouldn't know how to make sense of, and yet something that would be a shock to that field of sensitivity. You know, it has an impact. So, and whether we had troubled parenting, or whether we had very, very skillful, loving, stable, caring parenting, whatever happens, inevitably there's places where our sensitivity gets impacted in a way that has various shocks and traumas, and sets up various kind of patterns and responses in us. So inevitably, we kind of learn, it certainly seems to be completely inevitable. It seems to be the part of the way that a normal self-sense develops through childhood into adolescence and adulthood. A big part of how we develop seems to be that we start to mistrust and defend against this kind of sensitivity. We're wary of it. It seems too much. It seems dangerous. And we learn certain kind of coping strategies. So much of the self-sense we develop, what we were calling this morning the momentum of self, if we look carefully, seems to be ways of avoiding the kind of open, receptive orientation that we could call pure sensitivity. And just like you were saying this morning, you know, that recognition of some possibility for a still, silent, receptive sensitivity that we find we're actually afraid of. So it's no small thing, it's a tall order. It's maybe one of the most challenging things we can do, to consciously, to actively turn towards our sensitivity, to be willing to be very sensitive to what's happening, to both honour and enhance the basic human defining characteristic of being this organ of sensitivity. And that's why the wisdom and compassion bit, the skillful response bit, is so important. Otherwise, it's scary. It's maybe not even wise at all to just kind of open ourselves to the kind of flood of experience. We've learned these various coping mechanisms as ways to, as various kind of protections, so as to avoid feeling vulnerable. So as to avoid feeling the truth, partial truth, let's say, but to avoid feeling the truth that we're to some great extent at the mercy of life's vicissitudes. Avoid the truth that, you know, there's plenty of things in life we can't choose, that our life is fragile, that despite our, what's that thing about carefully laid plans of mice and men or something, I'm not quite sure how that goes, but despite our organisation of things and our attempt to kind of assume control over our life, we're kind of, what you could say, in the hands of the gods, or subject to, you know, the whims or winds of life and death and all that includes. So if we're going to, which is what we're doing with this kind of practice, honour and actually enhance our basic sensitivity through bringing our attention back again and again and again to sensitivity, to what's here, what's happening in body, what's happening in heart, what's happening in mind, then it's very important that along with that increase in sensitivity, along with making our sensitivity conscious, that we also have a skillful way of responding to it. Which, as I say, we could call the twin skills of wisdom and compassion. Wisdom meaning the orientation to whatever appears, whatever we're sensitive to, as seeing its nature, seeing its changing nature, seeing its kind of self-generated nature. And seeing, by a process of again and again looking at our experience in an experimental way, like we were also exploring this morning. What happens? What happens if I identify with it? What happens if I follow all the stories my mind produces? And seeing how that leads us into a kind of tight, nervous, neurotic, reactive way of meeting our experience. Seeing also what happens if I let what's here unfold within me without rejecting it, without pushing it away, and without kind of pursuing and interfering with it. I'm starting to see, I could say, wisdom starts to really see the way our experience can unfold and express and pass away without drama, without struggle, without neurosis. How do we start to, that wisdom starts to recognize that there's not, that what's going on here isn't worth clinging to isn't worth freaking out about. Whatever it is, it might be a hard lesson for us, but it's one we're invited to learn. Whatever it is, there's a wisdom kind of, sees that the self-unfolding nature of our experience. I'm trying to describe it without using too much Buddhist jargon. If I let myself slip some Buddhist jargon in there, we would say, for those of you who like Buddhist jargon, we might say, seize the emptiness of it. Compassion looks at that which we're sensitive to, movements of body and heart and mind, and cares, cradles, allows. That emphasis I'm putting this morning on letting what's here be here without making it wrong, without making it mean something about me, without it being a measure of who or how I am, without it being a stick to beat myself with. Oh, I'm so... Oh, I shouldn't be... Oh, I ought to... Oh, that shouldn't... And the kind of the neurotic tension that sets up. And wisdom sees through, and compassion allows. So as we practice to honour this natural sensitivity that we are, and enhance this natural sensitivity that we are, through training our attention to really kind of to let ourselves be sensitive, to let each touch, and that sensitivity seems to be able to go infinitely subtle. And sometimes, it might be such subtlety that we're sensitive to whole realms of experience that in an everyday sense we wouldn't hardly notice. And maybe, for example, just in meditation, somebody coughs in the room, and we feel a great depth of vibration just from a cough. Normally it would just impact as a sound, but there might be in the subtlety some sensitivity to the kind of vibratory waves of that cough. We might feel the cough in every cell of our being, it might feel like. So as we both honour and enhance our sensitivity, we start inevitably to meet it, somewhat clumsily we can say, with wisdom and compassion. I say clumsily because it makes those two qualities seem quite separate. Actually, I just read, I don't know where, somewhat recently, somebody saying, if wisdom isn't loving, it isn't really wise. And if love isn't wise, no, I'm misquoting as usual. But something like that, which was very nice. No? If wisdom isn't kind, it's not really wisdom. And if love isn't wise, it's not really love. And something like that. In other words, those two qualities turn out to be kind of two faces or aspects of the same quality. And the quality that somehow a kind of natural, truthful, authentic knowing of what frees up our consciousness, of what frees up this sensitivity. That's something very inherent in being a sensitive being. That as we train ourselves in that sensitivity, that which knows, and that's recognized in every cell, like when you have a real clear insight into something, it's not a good idea. Every cell in our body knows, this is a more helpful way to meet life. This is a more authentic way to meet life. This is a more free way to meet life. We call that authentic recognition either wisdom or compassion, depending on whether we're emphasizing the seeing through or whether we're emphasizing the kind of the tender, allowing spaciousness with it. Actually, we could just call it a quality of authenticity or a quality of freedom. And we start to recognize, dare, like again we were saying this morning, we start to dare to be sensitive. And the only way we can really dare to be sensitive is because we start to know increasingly a freeness to that sensitivity. Otherwise, feels scary and it feels like hard work. And just worth the noticing for ourselves. No? If we're just invited to be sensitive to all that's going on, but the wisdom and compassion isn't there, then it's scary and it's hard work. It's very difficult. Oh, to be sensitive all the time. Oh my God, there's so much going on. I'm going to feel bombarded. I'm going to feel overwhelmed. Sensitive to what? Oh, to you lot? I've got to keep things at bay here. Sensitive to myself, to my own inner kind of neuroses and worries and kind of jumping around mind and all that agitation. Sensitive to that. Oh. So we feel like I'll do a little bit of it. I'll sit in the morning for half an hour and then, oh, that's enough of being sensitive. Now I want to kind of barricade myself back into a familiar way of being. So these things kind of feed into each other. And it might take some time. It does take some time. What some time means, of course, is very different for everyone. But the more sincerity we put in, the smoother the process goes. That the more we honour and enhance sensitivity by being around, being inside, being closely in touch with what's happening, the more access we have to this authentic response. To meet what's here wisely, kindly, freely. And the more access, the more we see wisdom and compassion, in other words, the more we see freedom in action, the more that we naturally dare to be sensitive. The more that we dare to make room for ourselves. And as our field of sensitivity opens up, this world that we divide up rather clumsily, rather harshly, into this and that, me and you, here and there, could be, should be, ought to be, and all the kind of clumsy divisions start to dissolve. And even we could say the field of sensitivity, which I call this, me, and what we're sensitive to, the touches of life, that division also seems to dissolve. That division also starts to dissolve. Access to an undivided sense of life. And from a conventional view, when we're just identified with those clumsy or rigid kind of divisions, me and you, this and that, here and there, then the free response to life seems very mystical. The idea of what? The divisions between me and you dissolve? That sounds either just weird, right? Or it feels too much, like it might overwhelm me in some way. I'm really interested in keeping you at bay a little bit. Right? Or it sounds mystical, incomprehensible, strange, exotic. And we might imagine some kind of a mystical vision as painted in those airbrush tones in various New Age publications. But from conventionally, a kind of an undivided sense of reality looks mystic, exotic, and it may appear either as very seductive, very desirable, or it may even appear as something scary, and well, I don't want to go too far down that road. It might sound almost psychotic to us. Might do. But from what we could call the mystical perspective, it appears very simple to inhabit reality in such a way where it's not all divided up. Body, heart, mind, this, that, me, you, in, out, acceptable, not acceptable, okay, not okay, should, could, might, ought. From a more, inclusive, and from a more freer perspective, then the conventional way of seeing looks exotic, looks strange, looks like an awful lot of hard work to keep all those divisions going. So there's the promise and the invitation. And so kind of a map, we could say, of this kind of practice. To honour and enhance this field of sensitivity that we are. That we are undeniably. That we can't fail to notice that we are. As soon as we bring our attention to ourselves, what is it we bring attention to? When we say pay attention to our experience, what do we mean? We say, oh, to notice I'm this field of sensitivity. Sensitive to what's happening physically, emotionally, visually, aurally. Oh. To honour and enhance this sensitivity, guided by the skill of Dharma, by a willingness to investigate, to see clearly into, to see through, to dare to not tighten around what's happening. That we call wisdom. To dare to allow, to receive, to make room for, to love what's here. That we call compassion. And so there's a kind of feedback loop there, if you like. A feedback loop of sensing our experience and responding to it. The feedback loop of this field of sensitivity, you could say. And it's a feedback loop that's always there. It's inherent in our experience, but usually it's mostly unconscious. Or at least, let's say, it starts off as mostly unconscious. So, but nevertheless, you know, when we get cold, we recognise, oh, I'm cold, I need to put on a jacket. Right? That's that feedback loop. There's this field of sensitivity. If we're sensitive to cold, and we could say it's wisdom. It's a fairly low level of wisdom, but, you know, it's, nevertheless, I'm not trying to diss it. It's very helpful, right? I'm cold. Something recognises I'm cold and knows, oh, what I should do about it. Put on a sweater. And in a way, that very, very simple example, just to extrapolate that, because it seems, again, it seems infinite, the degree to which that sensitivity can develop, and therefore that feedback loop can develop, and therefore the wisdom of knowing what to do can develop. So, we've all, it's a kind of fairly straightforward developmental move as a human to know what to do. A very young baby knows it's cold, but it doesn't know I should put on a sweater. It knows it's cold and it just goes, ah, cold. Right? But we learn. So there's one developmental increment, we could say. We learn that kind of response to our sensitivity, that kind of feedback loop. And what would be another example? Well, something, you know, like around food. That's another developmental increment, we could say. That we learn, oh, I'm hungry, I need to eat. But even that's still a quite simple one, but it seems like it can get quite messed up. Right? If our alignment, if our attunement to the feedback loop of our sensitivity isn't very clear in some area, around food, for example, then there can be eating disorders. We might be eating plenty of times when we're not really hungry. Or we might be hungry, but we somehow are holding ourselves off from eating. So again, that's a very, very simple example of how a natural kind of wisdom works in relation to this physical sensitivity, hungry, so I eat. And yet we see that already there, some of our psychological complexities, some of our defences against sensitivity, some of our detunement to the natural processes of body and heart and mind can get interrupted in some way. So that around something as simple in theory as eating and nourishing the body can get skewed either in one direction or in the other. But as we attune to this feedback loop more and more, and that's what we're doing in meditation, in fact, that's what we're doing really with the whole of Dharma practice, whether in formal meditation, like we've been practicing today, or just in the informal contact of our life, we can always refer to, sensitize to, turn towards this kind of this feedback loop. I'm not sure if that's the best word I could find. It's like when I say feedback loop, what I'm meaning is this way of getting information. Like the example I gave of feeling cold. The information, I tune in and I know how to interpret that information. I'm cold. I put on the jumper. I tune to what's happening. I interpret the information. I'm hungry, so I eat. But both of those, like I said, are very, very simple ways of attuning to and recognizing the information that's already there, called cold or hungry. And the Dharma practice is really, if we keep on attuning and attuning and attuning to the information that's here, we start to find that there's more and more and more amazing information here. But some of that information, it's either very subtle, or it's just that we're so not used to attuning to it that we don't recognize it. Or we don't know what it means. And therefore we don't know what to do. So, in meditation like we're doing today, and in fact in the wider kind of the whole field of our life, the invitation is keep attuning to this field of sensitivity as a way of learning to recognize what's needed. Just like when we were growing up, we learned to recognize what hungry felt like and what hungry meant. I should, you know, what the need was, what I should do about it. We start to attune, for example, to our emotional experience. Anger, for example. we can all attune to anger to some extent, but if the attunement mechanism called meditative attention isn't very refined, isn't very developed, isn't very clear, then we tend to not understand anger. We get the information, angry, but we don't know what to do about it. And so what we do about it tends to be purely reactive. And what purely reactive looks like just depends on how our reactive patterns form. For some of this might be just trying to clamp it down. And some belief it's a terrible thing to get angry. Right? And I must hold it in. We go very still and silent and very uptight and rigid. Well, for others, it might be that we kind of turn that anger in on ourselves. How dare you get angry? That's a terrible thing to be angry. You shouldn't be angry. And it gets turned on and we get angry with ourselves for being angry. Or it might be that it just gets acted out. That it's so intolerable, this feeling of pressure and heat and tension inside, that we somehow lash out, verbally or physically, at somebody, as an attempt to deal with that anger. But as the attunement of meditative attention gets better, we start to be able to read the feedback loop better. We start to be able to read that information in a sensitivity. And because we're meeting it with what I've called with skill, with wisdom and compassion, we know what to do. We know to look into it. We know to explore it. We know, compassion knows, to allow it, to make room for it. And we start to notice, oh, the first layer that I react to when I'm not attuned is, oh, it's his fault, or it's her fault, or it's my fault, or, you know, it's God's fault, or it's someone's fault, and all that tension is there. And yet, next layer, then we start to attune to the way it moves, the heat, the bubbling, the frustration, the discomfort. And we learn to accommodate that discomfort. And the feedback loop, the information we get, oh, that authenticity I was just speaking about, we learn. If I attune to anger, if I let the heat and bubbling unfold, it doesn't need an expression. It doesn't need to be directed outwardly or be directed inwardly. It can move. It can just move. We start to learn, I can let life move. I can let life move freely. And so from this kind of feedback loop being largely unconscious and fairly low level, right? Probably works around cold or hot. Might work more or less well around hunger and other things. We start to have a sense of the extraordinary possibility of being able to consciously and continually be plugged in to this feedback loop that's constantly giving us information about what's happening and how to meet it. And that's really when our practice, I would say, gathers its own real momentum. As we learn to trust being plugged in to this feedback loop and the sensitivity. It's an extraordinary thing to be carrying this amount of kind of direct feedback information around with us. I'm aware this is starting to sound a bit kind of geeky, technological. Like, you know, we carry all these gadgets around with us to get lots of information off, right? But this is a different kind of information. This is direct, visceral, alive information about the nature of our consciousness. Look, right now, we can just attune to where we're at. And we'll find something here. We'll find engagement with what's being said, or we'll find boredom, or we'll find physical discomfort, or we'll find, I don't know what you'll find, but what do you find? Something. And that something is like a kind of signpost. It's like an invitation. You know, like in Alice in Wonderland, those things that eat me, or drink me, or whatever. Basically, the information we get from attuning to ourselves is, meet me, allow me, explore me, listen to me, make room for me. And our life starts to open up, starts to free itself up in unimaginable ways. Practice is the attunement. Practice is the training ourselves, training the capacity, enhancing the capacity to attune to what's happening. Teachings remind us, guide us in how to meet what we find there. How to meet means the wisdom and compassion, the looking into and exploring, the allowing and making room for. And as one of my teachers used to very, very often say to me, practice and teachings. Teachings and practice. Freedom is unstoppable. This field of consciousness is the greatest gadget. This feedback system of heart, mind, body, this sensory capacity, this field of sensitivity that we are, this organ of life knowing itself, expressing itself, contemplating itself, revealing itself. Practice to be close to it. Practice to attune to it. Practice to listen to it. Practice to recognize what's going on. And use the resources of wisdom that we have, and the teachings, and the guidance of those who've penetrated reality well, clearly, freely, in order to orientate ourselves to a wise and compassionate meeting with what we find here. Or another way of saying, in order to live freely. We don't need an idea of what it means to live freely. We don't need to think about how the Buddha lived freely, or how Jesus lived freely, or how our teacher lived freely, and try to emulate that. Don't try and be like the Buddha. Right? The Buddha solved his problem by listening to his field of sensitivity. Solve your problem by listening to your field of sensitivity. It's all happening here. It's all happening now. It's happening like this. Here, now, like this is all the information we need. As we tune in, we recognize those little Alice in Wonderland cards that our experience has, that says, you know, feel me, meet me, allow me, explore me. And then, increasingly, wondrously, body, mind, heart, world, here, there, this, that, all these seeming divisions can be met freely. Free life. The promise and the invitation of Dharma practice. May it be so for each one of us. For all those we have contact with. For anyone whose life is touched, whose interest is provoked by this kind of possibility. May all beings come to know a free life.